Welcome to Thriving Entrepreneur with your host, Steve Kidd, third-generation minister and 30-year business coach. Listen in as amazing, world-changing authors, speakers, and coaches share their struggles and victories, and hear from best-selling authors' insight into how you, too, can live your life as a thriving entrepreneur.
This is Steve. Welcome to Thriving Entrepreneur. We have a jam-packed show for you today, filled with system breakers and vision builders, people that are getting it done, and they're here today to show you how they're succeeding, and even when life throws the worst of things at them, how they press against the odds, and they do what needs to be done to, if necessary, break the system and build the vision that they know must be done. With that said, let's jump right in to our first guest. Join me in welcoming Letaxion. Hey, Letaxion, how are you doing today?
I'm doing all right. How are you doing, Mr. Kidd?
Doing really good, thanks. First off, Tell us a little bit about you and how you show up in the world.
A little bit about me?
Yes.
Well, you know, my name is Letaxion. I have a complicated past, but in 1998, I decided to change my past and turn it into a future and came by the selection and intervention. And that's when I hear that I created a curriculum, the 9 steps to empowerment process. And after 22 years of intervention, I was granted guilty by the government of the state of Washington. Upon my clemency and being released, I was a full-time student. Father. So that sums it up in a nutshell. But if I want anything to be taken from the interview by the listener, is that understand that first and foremost, I am a single father that loves his daughter.
I absolutely love that. And the book is called Justice for Ma'at. It's a true story of a father's relentless fight for his daughter. Tell us what ended up happening. Why did you have to end up fighting for your daughter?
I guess I'll start at the beginning. Like most fathers, you know, I chose to be present in my daughter's life, in her cultural and spiritual, and social and educational upbringing. And though I was a full-time student at the time, I made it a point to raise my daughter. So I was horrified after coming back from a business trip to find that the mother of my daughter had not only been in full-blown relapse, but she had been neglecting my daughter. Fast forward, TPS got involved, and after being incarcerated on an unrelated issue, a conspiracy was launched to erase me from my daughter's life. As a matter of fact, after the Office of the Family and Children Ombuds made a decision in the case, several licensed independent social workers also concluded that in fact there was a collusion on the part of racist maternal family members in the CPS social worker. And the judge ended up stating in open court that this case is tainted with the insidious shadow of racism. That is horrifying. So now I found myself fighting a well-resourced and governmental agency, not only backed by the state attorney general's office, who receives hundreds of millions of dollars of funding a year, but these agencies were filing false and perjurious documents to keep me out of my daughter's life. And if that was not enough, the attorney that I had paid to protect her life also signed these perjurious documents, which caused me to be denied visitation with my daughter. Now, this is not just an empty accusation. Social workers that have been terminated and reprimanded, and the attorney that I had paid to represent me, and an attorney from the Attorney General's office have been recommended for at least suspension by the Washington State Bar Association for their role in this travesty.
Wow. And so you go through the entire legal drama of this absolutely ridiculous thing that happened to you. Do tell us a little bit. Don't give us all of the spoiler, but do tell us, are things better now
the situation with your daughter?
Oh, well, what ended up transpiring is through the aggressive approach of an attorney that represented me and the judge, that in this case, I was able to secure custody of my daughter and get my daughter transferred down to California with her sister. It was rocky at first. You know, my daughter had suffered some issues concerning her race identity because of the family that was had her with her with them. You know, they were in fact racist. I mean, this was proven in court. This was proven in documentation. So my daughter would suffer from racial identity. So, but we've been working on that. You know, she's grown healthier and she's thriving and she's loving being in the presence of people to celebrate her and celebrate her ethnicity, both sides of her ethnicity. And everything is going well.
No, I totally love that. So, I mean, what can people who aren't going through what you have been through, what can they learn and what could they do to be a part of helping this not happen again?
Yeah. Well, you know, I wrote this book to expose the corruption within the governmental agency that are tasked and funded to protect the children and the parental rights. I think we as a society must understand that any given moment we may be faced with a circumstance wherein our parental rights are transgressed by these very same agencies. So I think that what we should do is be aware that this is transpiring and that not all people tasked with the duty to protect their children and parental rights are really carrying out their task with integrity. So we have to be aware of that, and we have to not just let the system continue to roll over and transgress our rights. And I think that, as a society, I think that's what we need to do. That's what we need to be at.
That's just so shocking for those of us who have never been involved with that, and yet those of us that have been single parents, we also know just how skewed against fathers to begin with the whole system is, let alone I can only imagine what you've been through. So is there an association or a group or a company that you're starting that you're, you know, going to be helping get justice for other children like yours?
Yes sir. I'm in the seminal stages of starting a nonprofit organization called Responsible Fathers. And this organization will, at its base, give those who are experiencing the same kind of thing the tools needed in order to protect their rights. Because a lot of times we come to these treatment procedures and this process, and we don't know the policies that govern the procedure. So we are being trampled over because we don't know those things. And I think that Responsible Fathers is the organization that will be able to give us the knowledge that we need and then offer some type of support with attorneys that are really engaged in protecting parental children's rights.
It's absolutely so important. So out of all the things, and I know you learned so many, but out of all the things you've learned, what is the one thing that sticks with you that you wish you would have known back before you started this whole thing?
I wish I would have known my rights. I wish I would have known my rights. And I think it always boils down to this. Those who don't have knowledge of the process and procedure are made victims by the process and procedure. I didn't know my rights. I thought that because I paid an attorney in order to protect my rights, that those rights would automatically be protected, not knowing that some attorneys will take your money and not do the things that they're obligated to do by being retained by you. So I think the biggest thing is that knowing my rights once this process began, was set in motion, just knowing the rights that I had and the policy and procedures that I needed to understand in order to protect myself and my child.
So good, and I'm glad you've taken up the fight. And just to kind of mention some other things you've done, you used to be a spokesperson for the NAACP in Spokane, Washington, and you're working on curriculum for removing or preventing gang violence and other things like that. What are some of the other kind of cool things you've done in the world?
Well, you know, I was also very active in the Black Lives Matter. I think that social justice is something that that has to be participated in, not only for Black people, but for all people. Everyone deserves and must have social justice in order to thrive and flourish in this society. I have created a curriculum called the 9 Steps to Empowerment Process, and while I was out there, I was going from state to state, negotiating truces between rival gang members, and also teaching a curriculum that will attack the miscreant aspect of the gang mentality, while simultaneously overstanding that gangs are really a social construct that many different ethnicities experience, and it's a necessary bonding place for the youth who don't have the parental or familial support that they need to have. But we want to kill the negative aspect of it, and we want to kill the criminal aspect of gang violence.
And of course, the book is called Justice for Ma'at, the true story of a father's relentless fight for his daughter. You can get it today for free on Amazon. We will have the link on all the social medias and stuff. I do hope that everybody will go out and get that. Letaxion, thanks so much for spending some time with us here on the show today.
Okay, and can I say one more thing?
Yes.
I think that we as a society must take a hard, long look at policies, procedures, laws, and statutes that govern both GPS and support process. I think those social workers and GALs and counselors must be held to a higher standard, and a form of independent oversight must be employed that we consistently evaluate process for abuses by those who are a part of the system but who are not conducting themselves for the betterment of that system. And I think that, and I would also like to say this, if you would like to have a conversation with me, or if you would like to reach out to me, you can text me or send me a voice message at 559-203-7720. I look forward to speaking with anybody that would like to speak to.
I appreciate it so much.
We are not going to stop. We're headed straight in to our next guest. Stick with us. Here we go. Join me in welcoming Clint Padgett. Hey, Clint, how are you doing today?
Doing great, Steve. How are you?
I'm doing good, thanks. First off, tell us a little bit about you and how you show up in the world.
So I'm based out of Atlanta, Georgia. We do project management for a living, basically. I get to do some really cool things like work with one of the major sponsors of the Summer and Winter Olympics and FIFA World Cups and Euros, and we plan their activations around those events. And then kind of a fun fact is a little kid who grew up in Orangeburg, South Carolina, and spent the first 18 years and never left the state, actually ran the torch in France for the last Olympic Games. So I've written 2 books on project management, published 2 books. One is called The Project Success Method, and one is How Teams Triumph. And we basically, my company's whole lifeblood is all around helping clients get better at planning and executing projects.
Absolutely. Love that. So how do teams triumph? I mean, what is the secret to success for a team?
Conversations. It's really conversations. It is forcing people out of their silos and actually having to come together and have a conversation or a dialogue. You know, I grew up thinking that conversation and communication were the same thing, and it turns out they're not. Communication, according to the dictionary, is just, it can be one way. It could be an email or a text message. It's basically just telling you a piece of data or informing you of something. A conversation, on the other hand, the definition of that is an oral exchange of information or ideas, and the key word there being exchange. So conversations add so much richness to what we want to get accomplished. You think about the last time there was this flurry of emails back and forth between you and a coworker, and you realize after the fact, after sending 20 emails back and forth, we could have answered this question if we just had a 3-minute phone call, right? So I think the secret sauce to how teams triumph is actually forcing them to have conversations and collaborate and work together. I say in project work, black and white is your friend and gray is the enemy. And the conversations help you figure out what's black, what's white, and what's gray, and get rid of the gray.
That makes total sense, although you and I might get accused of being two old guys talking about, talking about having in-person conversations.
Yeah, my son does it to me all the time. But I notice when he really, really wants something, he comes and talks to me and doesn't
Right.
just text me.
Well, yeah, absolutely. Communication. Let's dive into that for a second, though, because there's a difference between just talking and or talking at somebody and actually communicating with somebody. Can you give us some strategies and secrets into that?
You know, I think it's a common term, at least where I grew up in the South. I'm sure it's everywhere in the U.S., but it's, you know, you have two ears and one mouth, and you should use them in that ratio. You should do a lot more listening than you do talking. And I think one of the things that gets people off whack is they feel like they have to contribute. They feel like they have to say something. And I found you're better off just listening. And just listen and then only add context if it's really needed or if somebody asks your opinion. But I don't think you need to always be talking about something, you know, getting yourself involved, inserting yourself in the conversation. I talked to this lady, I read this research with, or I did some work with Allison Wood Brooks at Harvard, and I interviewed her about her, some research she had done, and she had this great term called boomer asking. And boomer asking is where you ask a person a question, only so the question, you know, so you, the ball gets hit back into your court, so then you can run with it. You have permission to run with it, basically. You want to dominate the conversation. So don't boomer ask, you know, and really be intentional. Again, this is definitely going to be something that dates us, but I'm a big fan of when I'm talking to somebody, I'm like, I'm making eye contact and I'm putting my phone away. I don't walk around with my phone anyway, but I put it in my pocket or something. There's nothing to me that's, when you're having a conversation with me and you pick up your phone and look down and start texting, that tells me I'm not important, that person on the other end of that phone is more important to you than I am right now. And that sends a wrong message. That's not collaborative. It doesn't make me really want to work with you. So to me, it's about being intentional, being in the moment and letting that person have that conversation. So you say, I'm here, I'm engaged with you, and I want to talk to you about whatever this topic is.
That's great. So talk to us a little bit about your latest book. It's called How Teams Triumph, Managing by Commitment. Tell us a little bit first about how you were inspired to write it.
So I didn't grow up in the Lawrenceburg, South Carolina, thinking I was going to write a book on communication. That was my goal. I grew up, I wanted to be an engineer my whole life. I knew that from the time I was a young boy, I wanted to be an engineer, electrical engineer specifically. And then when I got out and I went to work for this company that I work for now called Project Success, I've been there for 31 years now. And I teach classes in project management. And at first, so the class is really combines both of my books. One is more the technical aspects of the nuts and bolts of planning a project. How do you identify a task and a duration, all that technical stuff. And then the other piece is how do you communicate and collaborate and work together to make the project successful over time in, you know, 6 months, 12 months, 18 months, whatever that timeline might be. What I found was early in my career, I spent a lot of time talking about the nuts and bolts because it just made the most sense to me. And then as I progressed and I taught more and more people, I found myself speaking more about the people side of managing projects. And I said, okay, look, I got to get better at communicating about the people side, because a lot of times in these projects, a technical lead, somebody who's really good technically and has great technical skills, gets promoted to be a project manager, and they often are ill-equipped to do that role because they'd like to be by themselves. They'd like to be in silos. You know, I could talk bad about engineers because I am one. And so basically I want to go to my cubicle, design the perfect widget, leave me alone. I don't want to be bothered by your stupid meetings, and I'll come back eventually with my perfect widget and show it to you quite happily and proudly. At which point the marketing person says, well, there's nobody who wants to buy that. If you talk to me up front, we could have made this one change. We could sell a million units in Q1. We want to have that conversation. And I know sometimes these people that become project managers that have this technical background, they're not always that well-versed in the people side, the people skills. And so the second book, which is How Teams Triumph, was really trying to focus in and hone in on what are some things that I can give that person that's an engineer or the person who doesn't have the greatest people skills in the world. How can I inform them about how important it is to have these conversations and not avoid them, and how you go about doing so in a way that's going to be productive for the project and also leaves you feeling good about the process.
That makes total sense. I used to call that, in fact, the first half of my career, it felt like what I did was I translated tech back into human.
Oh, for sure. Absolutely. Part of your job as a project manager is you're translating between the people who are big picture and the people that are down in the weeds.
So how do we empower our team to relearn the almost lost art of communicating and talking to one another rather than, you know, sending back and forth those texts that never really communicate what they're talking about?
So what I try to do is find teaching points. So I just had a situation recently where two of my team members and I was copied on these emails, and there was a flurry, maybe 25 emails in about a 20-minute span, just back and forth. And I said, just stop. Let's have a call and get on the call and we'll solve this in 5 minutes. And we did. So that was, I just said, listen, if it's going to take you, if there's more than three or four emails back and forth, that just says you're not taking the right approach. To me, text messages, Jira, Slack post, or, you know, email, those are great for confirmation of here's what we discussed, here are the meeting notes, or a yes, or getting an answer to a yes, no question. But if there's context involved, if I need to know the tone of your voice, then I need to have a conversation with you. And I would even say, I really want to see your face, because even in the Zoom world, we don't often see the other person's face and what they're really feeling. And it's, I get tone of voice, which is great. But it just, it's, so I think you use teaching, but to go back to your question, you use teaching moments to say, here's, we could have solved this flurry of information. We could have solved this in 1 5-minute phone call. Or when something goes off the rails, because I interpreted an email, maybe I was having a bad day, and I interpret your email as you're accusing me of something, and you really weren't. It was just the way you worded it was, I took it the wrong way that day. And so I use that as a teaching point. Say, listen, he didn't mean to say this. Here's what he said. You took it the wrong way because you're having a bad day or whatever. If we'd have been in a room together, if we'd had a call or a face-to-face meeting even, I would have seen your face and realized you took it in a way that I did not intend, and I could have changed my words. No, what I mean is this, and I could have cut it off at the pass. So I just look for teaching moments.
I love that. So what kind of people, what kind of organizations do you work with?
We typically work with Fortune 500 companies, big global companies that have projects where deadlines are important. Everybody knows that if you think about project management, there's the three legs of the stool: time, cost, and quality. And all three are certainly important to us, but we tend to work best in environments where deadlines matter. And, you know, I like to tell people, if you just want to check the box, you're doing project management, you probably don't want to use us, because we add more rigor than you probably want. But if you're going to get fired, or you're going to lose a client, or you're not going to get that promotion because you missed a deadline, that we can help you, because we can help you understand what your timeline is working with your team, and then help you figure out the critical path for that project and help you massage it to get it back on track or realize you can't do it at all. And that's a great benefit to our clients. So they tend to be global companies that are quite large.
So how does a person work with you? Where would they go? What kind of things do they need to do to get to be able to work with you?
So it's pretty easy, actually. We can go to projectsuccess.com. You can look me up on LinkedIn. I'm just Clint Padgett, PADGETT. And then we really just do two things in life. For 41 years now, we teach classes and how to do it. And then a lot of our clients will say, this is great. This classroom training was fantastic. Some of the best we ever had. We've trained over 43,000 people in this process. But how about, can you come work with me on this next project and help me do it right? And then basically we work ourselves out of a job. So that's kind of our mantra, is we help train you, and then we help you get it installed in your situation and it works in your world, and then you're self-sufficient and we back out.
So speaking of mantras, give us a few words of encouragement before I let you go about how a person can get their team to really communicate well together.
So the first project is always the hardest one, Steve. Basically, people have, when I'm working with a client for the first time, there's always this pushback of, you know, let me give you an example. So basically, project management is a phrase that can make people run from the room screaming, right? And if I'm teaching a class of 40 people, there's always two or three that don't want to be there. And I'll tell them that. I said, listen, I know there's probably two or three of you. The only reason you're in the room today is because your boss said, go take this class on project management. And that's the only reason you're here. And the reason you don't want to come to this class, one of them might be that your whole life experience is when somebody says, hey, we're doing project management. What that really means is Fred's going to go sit off here in a corner by himself. He's going to develop a timeline. He's going to identify all the activities in a way that makes sense to him, but not me. He's going to assign my name to tasks that I don't even agree with. And then he's going to use a random number generator to pick the durations for them. And then somehow hold me accountable to deliver that schedule for which I had no input. Well, if that is, and then use that schedule to beat me over the head with and tell my boss I'm not doing a good job. Well, if that is your life experience in project management, I would want to run from the room screaming as well. What project management should be is a helpful process. What we're going to do is, and what people find when they go through the process is, the first thing it does is get rid of all the gray, because we're going to have a conversation. We're going to get in a room together for 2 or 3 days. And over that 2 or 3 days, the first thing we're going to agree on is the scope. And we're going to argue about it. This is in, this is out. And we're going to finally come to an agreement, whether it's in or out. And if it's in, we plan for it. If it's out, we don't. And then we're going to look eyeball to eyeball and say, who in this room is going to own this task? And that person has to say, it's me. I'm going to do it. And then we're going to look at that person and go, okay, well, then how long do you need? And my least favorite thing is when they come back and say, well, how long do I have? Because then I go right back and say, no, that's not the question. You tell me how long you need to do your task right. And then we put that amount of time in. I said, now what do you need from other people? Those are what we call the predecessors. And through that process, through this conversation, we build these really complex projects of 20,000 activities sometimes, but the team is completely bought into it. It's not a paper schedule. They love it. And after every one of these planning sessions, even the most reluctant person who came into the session going, this is a complete waste of time. I could be getting real work done. At the end of that planning process, which is usually about 3 days, they all say the same thing. We should have been doing this on all of our projects. So the encouragement I would give you is do the first one. Once the first one is over, you'll have people that are converts and want to do on all your projects. They'll be screaming to get on board your team.
And give us your URL one more time.
It's projectsuccess.com.
Perfect. Well, Clint, thanks so much for spending some time with us here on the show today.
No, thanks for having me.
So much great experience and things that we can learn from Clint. And you too can be a system breaker and a vision builder and live as a thriving entrepreneur. You like what you've heard so far? Let's jump right in to our next guest here on Thriving Entrepreneur. Here we go. Join me in welcoming Leslie Grandy. Hey, Leslie, how you doing today?
Hey, nice to meet you. And I'm excited to be here.
So glad to have you here with us. Start us off by telling us a little bit about you and how you show up in the world.
Sure. I recently wrote a book that'll be published by Wiley in May of 2025. But before that, I worked for 25 years as a product executive at companies like Apple, Amazon, T-Mobile, and Best Buy. And in between those stints, I served as a board advisor for startups and supported a number of my friends who are entrepreneurs as they were launching their business in a variety of domains, from mobile security to immersive real estate experiences. And so I have a product consultancy called the Product Guild, through which I advise companies large and small. And that's what I'm doing these days.
Perfect. I love that. So what kind of advice do you find yourself giving people these days in that realm?
It's interesting. I think a lot of people struggle to figure out how to leverage AI through the innovation and ideation process in an efficient and effective manner, especially if they don't see themselves as creative. Maybe they're more operational or business focused, financial thinking of investment dollars and things like that. But maybe it's also that they just haven't had the opportunity to exercise their creative muscles. And so they therefore don't know how to sort of amplify their own creativity with generative AI.
So for people that have been living under a rock or something and don't really understand what generative AI is, give us kind of a little primer of how it works for them and what kind of things can it do?
Well, in some ways, the easiest way to think of generative AI is the way you would input to a search box if you weren't trained by Google search to ask a question. and to add all sorts of additional content into that conversation that would be too many words for Google search to parse in order to get you to the right answer. And then you'd get a list of answers if you were doing that with Google. But if you actually do it in a conversational format with a generative AI partner, it will access a vast amount of data and synthesize that information into a result that then you can use as a to further converse, explore the idea, challenge the thinking, see what other details you might need, look for the sources or experts or authorities in the field. And I find that in the way I use it, it really is to validate my thinking, but also to validate that I haven't missed something in my thinking. And because AI is so much more comprehensive and expansive in the data that it uses to provide the output, I often think I know what I know because I've worked in the industry or I've done this role for so long. But it's always great to have someone say, "Hey, but did you think about this?" Or, "What about this way of thinking about it?" And because it's really a data model that's providing the answers, there's a lot of psychological distance and not a lot of attachment. And so it's helpful because it brings feedback to me that maybe I would think initially was ridiculous, but in the construct of this conversation, AI can help me explore it more deeply and fully. And so it provides me a psychological distance from the thing that I might be enamored with. And as an entrepreneur or advising entrepreneurs, it's always important for people to realize they're trying to fall in love with the problem and not the solution and not get too wrapped up in one particular way of doing things. And generative AI can provide multiple perspectives on how to do something.
I totally love that. And of course, it's all in the quality of your questions. If you ask it,
Totally.
not good questions, you're going to get not good answers. So how does a person know, or maybe better yet, how do you help a person know what to ask and what not to ask, or what do you ask on their behalf? How does that work?
Yeah, that's a great question because I think a lot of people think about the tactics of engineering your prompt to get the right answer. But I think the way to think about it is slightly different than that. I think that there are frameworks for problem solving or frameworks for ideation that can be used to manage the conversation more thoroughly. And so if you were to look at something like the scamper technique, it's a way for you to ask questions that allow you to explore different ways you might change the materials or reverse the process or adapt something from another area into this area. And so, if you're using these frameworks, you don't have to think of all the words in your prompt engineering. The frameworks give you that structure and that they give you that confidence, right? That the conversation is going to be thoughtfully structured towards an outcome as opposed to a random walk through space. And so I think if you're nervous about your own creative capacity or confident in your ability to ideate, which a lot of people are, I overcame that fear and recognized that that becomes a strength, not really being stuck with one way of doing things and learning things that can help me solve future problems. And so that's what AI is to me. It's sort of my partner in solving problems because I can ask the question with these frameworks and work my way through the problem in a structured manner. And that's a great place to start is to look at some of these frameworks. Scamper is one, Synectics is another. How might we is a favorite of design thinkers. And these structures then get you a bunch of answers that you can challenge and explore. And to me, that's the first hurdle is getting the conversation going. Right. And then it is always advised, even if you're an expert, to iterate the answer, to challenge the answer, to think about what if I change this in the answer, what might happen? And so now you're really batting the ball back and forth with someone who becomes sort of your thought partner. And that's what I think is the best thing to think about is that this is somebody who isn't going to give you the answer, but is going to amplify your own creativity.
I love it. So, give us some examples of some people that you've worked with and the kind of, successes that they're having using your system.
Yeah, it's terrific. One of the people that I interviewed for my new book, which is called Creative Velocity: Propelling Breakthrough Ideas in the Age of Generative AI, one of the people I interviewed was the CEO of Red Robin Gourmet Burgers. And she put together an innovation advisory council. And I was on that council. She invited me to join. And the goal here was to really understand the disruptions that were happening in food services and the opportunities they presented as these changes became inevitable. And so, within that framework, with this group of people, we were able to explore a lot of what-if scenarios, but also to look from the outside with some amount of zero-gravity thinking to challenge the status quo. Well, what's the opposite of what you want to happen, and how do we prepare for that potential outcome? What are the ways we can mitigate the risk from that potential outcome? What are the circumstances that cause that potential outcome? And so, in these kind of discussions, we were able to really look at different aspects of the food services industry that we could bring to bear in our recommendations.
I love it. So, do you have any specific examples beyond the food service industry, or is it mostly all in the food service industry that
No,
you
no.
specialize?
At when I was at Best Buy, one of the things that we were very challenged with was a lot of data about the experience for customers in the store as the number of employees in the store was changing. And there was perceived to be an idea that maybe the way to compensate for that was to do a page a blue shirt type of service, some way to be able to allow a customer through their phone to page for help. But instinctively, we didn't see the data or the evidence that this would be the right solution. It seemed more like a problem that they were looking for a solution for that maybe had been misdefined. What was the problem that was defined that made that outcome be the right one? Well, we couldn't find that connection. And so when we did our own exploration, one of the things that we looked for and that we focused on was the getting help part of that problem statement. What about getting help was hard? And when you actually ask the question that really says, are these the right words to describe the problem? You actually end up seeing that the problem may be narrowly defined, so narrowly that the solution you come up with isn't actually useful. And that's what we discovered by saying, wait a minute, is that really the problem in the store? And we interviewed customers, and in a classic human-centered design way, we found out customers can find help, they just can't find the right help, the right skills in the person that they need to help them finance a refrigerator or choose a mobile plan. Those are very specific kinds of help. And so we changed the order of what we thought was important. And it wasn't about finding help, it was being able to identify the right person for your needs in that moment, which is difficult to do when you just look at a bunch of employees on a retail showroom floor. And so we devised a system where it would be much easier to match a customer with the type of help they were needing that really wasn't so much a paging system as a queuing system. And by redefining and reframing the problem, we recognized that we could solve the pain point for more customers.
That's amazing. So, what kind of people, what kind of businesses do you prefer to work with?
Well, I really, as a naturally curious person, I really don't limit myself to particular domains or industries. I've supported companies in the startup space that aren't necessarily ones that are in the sphere of the larger corporations I've worked with. I have done some of that. I obviously got some of the mobile work I did from having launched the first Android phone and having the reputation of being somebody who was responsible for that platform and knew that platform. So people looking to enter that space were looking for that expertise. But that was a unique situation in terms of scaling the developer community for Android. But outside of that, I'm really most likely to be engaged with a company that's doing some sort of transformation, either a transformation of a business model or a transformation from physical to digital. And in that transformation, helping and guiding people through a series of activities that will create that new identity for them while still maintaining what it is in their business that makes their brand special.
And how would a person go about working with you?
Well, I have a website where you can find out about both the book and the workshops I do, and it's possible to reach out to me through there to book a consultation. And the website is creative-velocity.com. And that is the name of the book, Creative Velocity. So the website, creative-velocity, takes you to sort of a book forward page, but there is in the top nav an opportunity to book me through that site.
Wonderful. Well, before I let you go, give us one more word of encouragement about how powerfully we can show up, and find real solutions to the problems we're running into in our businesses.
That's such a great question. To me, I think that people need to know two really critical things that I learned while researching the book and that really were validated by deep research in creativity over the last decade or so, and which is when people have focused mostly on it. One is that creativity is actually everyone's superpower, and it's up to people to access it, activate it, indulge it, nurture it, and practice it in order to be able to have the habits that will enable creative, innovative, inventive ideas to emerge. And part of those practices are things like knowing your triggers, being self-aware, regulating your emotions, things that allow you to be open to new experiences, to find your flow. And so that sense that there are things you can do to activate your own creative capacity and expand it is the most important thing I want everyone to know. You can't tell me and have me buy it that creativity is somebody else's job. It just isn't. It's a job for everyone, regardless of role, level, or size of the company. And so that's my first thing. And the second thing is a sort of a subset of that, which is our minds are capable of remarkable things, but we have to be able to tap into them. We have to know how to activate them. And so there are practice exercises and habits that you can develop that make it easier to nurture that when you need to call upon it. But the idea that your cognitive abilities are trainable, they're a state, not a trait, right? You are able to be in a state of problem solving differently after you've had a serious accident than you are on a bright, sunny summer day when you're walking, in a park. And so it's a state, it's not a trait. It's something you can develop, it's something that you can work towards, and it's because your mind is capable of that type of training and that type of learning that allows us to develop skills we don't have cognitively.
Well, Leslie, I appreciate all that you're doing in the world, and thank you so much for being a guest here on the show today.
Oh, thanks. Your questions are awesome, Steve. I really appreciate it.
What a powerhouse. Do you have the ability to listen to one more? I hope you do. We've got one more really great guest that also is a system breaker and a vision builder and is living as a thriving entrepreneur and has a great message for you from all of her years of experience to help you truly thrive. Listen in. Join me in welcoming Dwan Bent Twyford. Hey, Dwan, how are you doing today?
So good. I'm excited to be talking to you today, Steve.
Yeah, absolutely. So glad to have you here with us. First off, tell us a little bit about you and how you show up in the world.
Wow. I guess I show up in the world as a real estate investor, and that's what I do for my work. And I've been investing for over 30 years, and I've done over 2,000 deals. Like $500 million worth of real estate, and I'm just rocking along.
So, what got you started investing in real estate? What was your first deal?
Well, it's funny. A lot of people that would be listening to a show like this, they would already be interested in being in real estate. And I didn't know anything about it. I wasn't looking for it, but I was married. I was 30 years old. I had an 8-month-old baby. My husband and I had a really kind of wicked, unexpected breakup. And now I have an 8-month-old baby. I'm 30 years old. I have never done anything but work in the bar business. And I met some people and they go, oh, yeah, we buy houses, we fix them up, we sell them. And my naive mind thought, oh, they decorate. Well, decorating is fun. How hard could that be? And so I went door knocking. I found a deal. I moved into it. I did decorate it. And then I realized decorating, not the same thing as rehabbing. And I started going to Home Depot, taking all the classes, rehab my first house. I made $22,000 and never, literally never looked back.
That's great. So, and you've been doing this for 30 years now. So obviously you've had, must be working for you. You know, it's not something that wasn't working out, or you wouldn't have probably stuck to it that long. Talk to us a little bit about some of the ups and downs that you've experienced over the course of, you know, all this time doing that.
You know, actually, my daughter just turned 36 this year. So I guess I've been investing for like 35 years, which is hard to believe. I'm like, I don't even understand how that is. I still feel like I'm in my 30s. So, you know, I started so long ago before, you know, the internet, before GPS, before pagers, even like really old school. So a lot of the technology along the way has certainly made it better. You can find deals on the courthouse. Everything's online. You can do a lot of things with not having to go like the old-fashioned way, like I did. So I do like that. It's made it a lot easier. But you know, after all these years, Steve, I still like to work directly with homeowners that are in distress. Because homeowners in distress, they're losing their house. The whole world's upside down, and they need somebody to step in and help them and kind of look after them. So I still, after all this, still like to work directly with homeowners, like opposed to like the MLS or something like that, because I was one of those homeowners. I lost my house. I had my car was repossessed. I went through a lot of stuff when I went through my divorce. So I don't know. I've kind of just always had a heart for people and I've kind of stayed in my lane.
And so you like working with people whose houses are in distress. You kind of help them get out of a bad situation, get their house sold for them, and then they can move on and you make some money. Is that kind of the concept?
Yeah, so we find the people, which is for anybody listening, it's public record at every county courthouse in the United States, has all the foreclosures, bankruptcy, divorce, probate, like all of it's there. And we specifically try to help the people that are in trouble, just because, you know, like, I don't know, people don't help them sometimes. And so we get them to move out, and then we'll either wholesale the property or maybe do a short sale or we'll rehab it. It just depends on each individual situation. But we give them money so they can get a fresh start to move. We obviously make money. We never make less than $30,000 per deal. And, you know, we do 50, 60, 70 deals a year. So we do good with the real estate. And then, of course, I coach and mentor people and help other people do it because I've been so successful myself. I want other people to be successful too. So I'm a great coach.
I love that. Well, and I love the fact that you said that, you know, you haven't had everything just be sunshine and roses financially for you the whole entire time. Because most people, when they start thinking about investing in real estate, they immediately feel like it's impossible for them because they don't have their finances in the right, quote unquote, order to be able to start doing it. How does a person go about investing in real estate if they, you know, kind of in need of money themselves?
Well, you know, that's interesting because my first deal, I mean, I really seriously, when I tell you I was broke, I was broke. I mean, my car was gone, my house was gone. You know, I had my daughter, so I'm like, hey, I came out on the winning end of that deal anyway. But there are a lot of homeowners that sometimes you could take over their payment. Sometimes they can do what's called a subject to. They'll deed their house to you, and then you can turn around and use it as a rental and, you know, collect money. The money that you collect to bring up the back payments. So there's a lot of things that you can do that are what's called creative financing. You should never not be able to work with somebody. If it's a good deal, you got a motivated homeowner, you can figure out a way to make that deal work. My finances were in the toilet. I probably didn't have enough credit to actually get a pack of gum. And I borrowed $3,000 from my aunt and bought like a ratty old car. I was like, I'm going to make this happen. I want to raise my daughter. I don't want to put her in daycare. I had planned on being like the Girl Scout mom, the homeroom mom, the sleepover mom. And I thought, you know, I'm not going to let my ex-husband shatter that for me. I'm going to stick to my guns and figure it out and work for myself. And if all else fails, I could get a job. But I knew if I got a job, I'd never take the chance on real estate. So I took the chance on real estate first with a job as a backup idea. And after 6 or 7 a month of just working for myself, I was like, I'm never going back and working for anybody else. And I never have.
I absolutely love that. So, some people have probably heard of some of the things you'd mentioned, but one of the things you mentioned was a subject to existing. Can you explain to people how that kind of a process works?
Yes, that's one of my favorite things. My husband and I have done like 375 subject twos. So they're something that's in, our regular part of real estate investing. So maybe you find a homeowner, they don't have a lot of equity. Maybe they have a $200,000 house, they owe $200,000. Not a lot of equity, but they're a few payments behind. So we have them do what's called a subject two. They deed the house to us, so we become the owner. Their name stays on the mortgage, so I'm not qualifying to buy the house. And then I offer it out as owner financing to another person. And the person that is going to buy it owner financing is going to give me 10% down, which is, 20 or 25, 30,000. I'm going to take that money and make up the back payments. And then they're going to pay me. And I'm going to pay the bank. They're going to pay me. I'm going to pay the bank. We're going to do that for 5 years. Then the original homeowner, they have 5 years of on-time mortgage payment, so it helps fix their credit. The person I sold it to can't go to a bank, so this is also going to help their credit improve. And it creates a win-win for everybody. So someone can get into a house for not a lot of money down. I become the bank, which is really nice because I become the bank, not the landlord, and not, what I'm the bank. And the original homeowner moves on. I make money every month. The guy that bought it from me refinances in 5 years, and it creates a super great win-win situation for everybody.
I absolutely love that. And you had mentioned you find those going down to the county records office. You can find ones like that there as well.
You can print out all the foreclosures on your computer now. And I think most people tend to go, oh, hey, because when you print it out off the courthouse, it usually tells the bank what they owe, what the mortgage is, how many payments behind it, if there's a sale date set, all that stuff is part of the public records. So I think most investors, Steve, they're like, well, I'm going to go look at this house because it's got a bunch of equity. But the problem is everybody looks for all the houses with equity. So you got 20 investors going there. Whereas I look at the foreclosures, I was like, okay, well, this house is 300, they owe 300. There's no equity, no other investor's gonna go there. I'm gonna go with the intention of trying to do a subject two. And homeowners are fine to deed their house to you. They have to have faith and trust. We put everything in writing, like it's super papered up for them and for me. And I find someone that's like, hey, you wanna buy a house, owner financing, no credit, no problem. I will give you a new mortgage. You give me a down payment. I make up the back payments, and literally everybody wins. So I actually look for the people that don't have equity because nobody else talks to them. Nobody.
I completely love that. That is awesome.
Yeah.
Are these houses that you get, are most of them listed for sale, or most of them not even listed?
No. If they're listed, I can't work with one that's listed because I don't can't pay the real estate commission and all the stuff like that. So we find like when people are freshly served the foreclosure notice, the notice of default, that's when it gets listed at the public, at the county courthouse. So we look for like the new listings, not the new, but the new filings. We look for the new filings and I have some door knockers, people that find them on social media, and we reach out to them that way. We send letters, we call, just all the stuff. But I have some door knockers, and I feel like that really is a big advantage because most people don't do that. And we just start talking and, see who wants to work with us, basically. But I personally just like working the deals without the equity because, again, there's no competition on that side of it. If someone's got a $400,000 house, they owe 200, everyone's gonna go there like, oh, this is a great deal. But everybody's going after that.
I totally love that. Well, that's amazing. So, give us
an idea of the kind of people that you now are teaching and coaching so that people all around the world can learn from you and join your course?
Yeah. So, it's funny. I've been teaching. I think I started teaching probably 20 years ago because I just remember thinking like I was a broke single mom. I was actually fired from Denny's on third shift. And I was like, if a broke single mom fired for Denny's can turn around and become a millionaire, everybody can do it. Like, literally, everybody can do it. So I started teaching about 20 years ago and a lot to women initially because I went through the divorce and all this, lost all my stuff, and like I get it, And of course, over that time, it's spread to, we have over 500,000 students that have gone through our program, and we just work with them. We teach them how to do it. We talk to each individual person and find out, do you work? Do you not work? Do you have money? Do you have free time? When can you do this? And we set them on a schedule. We give them all the tools that they need. They can be a part of our coaching system. And like we directly answer their questions personally. And they'll ship them off to some phone room in Utah. And we have had just really successful students. I mean, I have people from all ages and millennials and that went to college and ran up these giant bills and they don't actually like being in the industry that they went to college for. Lots of boomers that are like retiring and hey, I don't have enough money to retire on like I thought I would. I'm gonna have to work. And just really anyone, Gen X, they're just like, they're like, hey, my kids are growing up and I'm realizing we don't have enough money. And, just there's really no specific age group. We literally have people from all walks of life, all colors, all creeds, all sizes, all forms of different educations. Just, and they love working with us because we actually hold their hand and we help them.
That's amazing. Well,
Yeah, it's
tell
super
us,
fun.
tell us the URL. Where do they go to connect with you?
So my name is Dwan, and I started a podcast called The Most Dwanderful Real Estate Podcast Ever. So I took Dwan and Wonderful, and I made a new word, Dwanderful. So they can go to dwanderful.com. They can take my little real estate investing quiz, and it'll tell them where they are, what they need, what they already know. It's a really great quiz for them to take. And we'll give them a call and say, hey, we saw your quiz and how can we help you?
That's
So,
amazing.
yeah, so it's really great. Like, it's really great.
Well, that's amazing. Dwan, that's exciting what you're doing. I hope some people will go there and join your system and join your course. Thank you so much for being a guest here on the show with us today.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Steve. I appreciate it a lot.
Hope you took notes on that. A lot of great experience in the real estate field and a absolute vision builder and system breaker and system creator as well. I hope that you got a lot from that, and I hope more than anything, what you saw from all the guests today is the insight into the fact that you are uniquely brilliant. You were created for a purpose, and the world needs you. We need you to be a system breaker, a vision builder. We need you to be a thriving entrepreneur. It's what we want from you, it's what we need from you, and it's what you were created to be, a thriving entrepreneur. I hope until we're together again next time that you have an amazingly great week.
Thanks for listening to Thriving Entrepreneur today. If you want to get your question answered, send an email to questions@wehelpyouthrive.com. We look forward to you joining us again next time.
Hi, my name is Steve Kidd. I am a third generation minister, an international best-selling author of multiple books, and I help people write, publish, and market their books to bestseller. In fact, there are literally thousands of people that have used the system that I created to be able to write, publish, and market their books, and now they're best-selling authors, and you're next. I just wanted to come on for a minute, say hi to you, tell you a little bit about me, introduce myself, and tell you I know the world is waiting on your message, and I would be so honored to be part of sharing your message with the world.
go to asksstevekid.com and schedule a time to talk today.